Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name's Dick. You'll also hear a few other guys on this repeater that run this technet on Sunday nights. And that's John KC2WGV, who handles the mailbag and monitors Echo Link. Later on, you'll hear Paul WS2N, who gives us the latest on what NASA is doing, National Aeronautics and Space Administration. The reason I give this explanation at the beginning of the TechNet is every so often, believe it or not, even though it's, the TechNet's been around for 32 years, there are people who suddenly tune around with their scanner or their regular ham radio repeater, the ham radio equipment, and suddenly discover the TechNet that they hadn't heard about before that. So there are people who come upon this thing later and they want to know, what in the world is it? And what is it? It's a gathering of curious people. Let me drop it. A gathering of curious people who want to know more about wireless equipment, radio equipment, ham radio equipment in particular, but not necessarily. Quite often it involves broadcast two-way radios, GMRS, and GPS, and so on, global positioning satellite systems. Anything to do with wireless equipment, they want to know more about it. It's a complicated subject, and schools do a mediocre job at best of teaching it in a useful engineering manner. The books do a fairly good job, but you have to get a whole lot of books to really learn the whole subject. And there's an awful lot to it. Just ham radio itself has about 25 or 26 different kinds of ham radio. 2-meter repeater ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the 26 kinds. Arguably, it's one of the most educational hobbies that exists. So if the particular one of the 25 or 26 kinds of ham radio that you're using displeases you before you give up the whole hobby, try one of the other 25. Let me drop. There's a very loose menu that John and I and Paul follow, which is the first hour approximately. We take general questions from people who do have a question or a comment for the net. We have them sign in by giving their call letters and their name and the word yes, which means they do have a question or a comment. You need that sign in because you're listening. And for 32 and a half years, we believe somebody is listening. There's something like 6,000 hours worth of TechNets that are all recorded. And you can play back past TechNets, whether it be a week ago or 5 or 7 years ago, by going to the website of www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Go to that website, amateurradio.tangovictor. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can play back past TechNets. It comes in 1 hour reels. Each TechNet lasts for 4 hours. For the last 20 or so years, because people used to complain that there wasn't enough time to get their questions and answers in the 1 hour that it used to be in the very beginning. So it eventually crawled all the way up to 4 hours. So from 8 o'clock to Sunday to midnight, every Sunday night for the last zillion years, the TechNet meets and people exchange information. Not everything you're going to hear is 100% accurate. All the people involved do a very sincere job of trying to make that happen, but errors occur. And so every so often you run into somebody that I've been listening to the TechNet, and I found they made this error 2 weeks ago. I'm not going to listen to them anymore. Well, talk to any realistic engineer, no matter how hard he tries. He's occasionally going to make a pronouncement or do an action that is an error. Nobody bats a thousand. So you're going to hear errors from time to time. This is kind of peer-reviewed material by way of the website. People play it back, listen to it, and soon inform us that, hey, 2 weeks ago you said so-and-so, you should have said such-and-such. And as you've heard me say often, a realistic engineer will admit that he's going to make an error once in a while. And when somebody points it out to him, the smartest thing he can do is laugh at himself, profit from the experience, and go on from there. Unfortunately, I've met kinds of engineers that will deny to the end of the earth that they've never made an error. Let me drop. They somehow assume that the particular school that he went to gave them infinite knowledge and they're never going to make a mistake. That's not realistic. But we do our best. And so John and I and Paul and Hal give answers a high percentage of the time. Not all the time. There's a hell of a lot of subjects we're not expert on. So, because this TechNet covers the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, and by way of Echolink and IRLP, it covers multiple states, in some cases multiple countries, Canada in particular. Quite often a person from far out in the hinterland say, I've got some experience on that subject, and they come and give us the more correct answer. They give us the benefit of their knowledge and experience. Let me drop it. Now, one of the real fun type things that, one of the most enjoyable things I've ever done in ham radio, other than putting up big antennas that talk very long distances on VHF and UHF and SHF frequencies, I'm a microwaver. And although I've got an extra class license, I've used HF very little. But one of the fun things I've done over the years is that Bruce N2LIV, Bruce Wood, who is now a Silent Key, he and I would periodically go to mountain tops and sometimes even the top of a parking garage, a three-story parking garage in Ronkonkoma, for instance, to opera and beachfront, to operate on 10 gigahertz during the contest. So contest portable operation is a real fun kind of ham radio. There's a whole class of people today who like doing QRP, HF, portable ham radio. And one of the guys who does that a lot is Rich, K2UPS. And hopefully he's listening to us right now, K2UPS Mobile. So I'm going to be asking him later on to, let me drop it. To describe a little bit of his operation, I visited one of his operations when he was on top of a so-called mountain on James Hill in Huntington at the High Hills, I think it's called, a parking area, a recreation area. Park, the West Hills Park in Huntington. I visited him once, watched his portable operation. He's having a lot of fun. So if he's available tonight, I'm going to have him give a little bit more description of how he does his portable QRP HF operations. He's sort of invented or adapted a number of antennas that he can put on his cheap light vehicle that go up to some nice high altitudes, even though there's not a great big installation to it. And he gets some real fun operations on the 8 to 10 meter band. And maybe even the 6-meter band. He'll tell us about that. Also, as you know, there was a Limark flea market today at Briarcliff College, I think is where it was held. And so for those guys who went to that and bought some real good bargains, or one got away, I'd like these guys to describe what the flea market was like for you today. Let me jump. And I hear tell that the new... a buzzword these days is the DMR radio, and quite possibly there's going to be people who want to discuss a DMR, the latest and the greatest thing, which has some of the properties of cell phone operation, but ham radio that allows people to be connected over very long distances on what looks like 2-meter repeater operation, but it's got a lot more properties than that, digital characteristics and so on. So these are some of the subjects we're going to be discussing. Okay. At this time, you guys are going to sign in, give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes. A typical sign-in would sound like this. K2 Uncle Papa Sierra, Rich, and yes. So do we have any check-ins? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
Yep. KC2MDP, Steve, and yes.
Tomeo, Rich, yes.
Okay, we got Steve and Rich so far, and I think there was a double in there. Who else was trying to sign in?
1YDY, Hank, yes.
Okay, we got Hank. So, Steve, Rich, and Hank. Anyone else decided? Give me your call letters right now.
WS2N.
Paul, it's a space report. Good evening, everybody.
And out of curiosity, Paul, is that going to be space report number 152 of the series? Over to you, Paul.
Yes, it is, QSL. We're up to 152 on the computer here. I could go back that far. Anything before that, we'll have to go to amateur radio TV. Back to you, Dick.
Now, Steve, Paul, run that by again. Right now on your computer, your space reports go up to number 152. And as you guys can tell, each of us have a real obsession or passion. Let's call it a passion. traction of his life about what happens in space, what is National Aeronautics and Space Administration doing. So are you implying that if we go back further in time than space report number one, that there were a whole lot of pre-numbered space reports that were on the TechNet? If so, make a guess for how many years you did that before you started numbering them. Back to you, Paul, WSUM-K2LAW.
Well, let's see, how many years ago was that? Probably, I don't know, 10, 12, 13 years ago at least. That I haven't been on every week, but I have, since I've been keeping track, let me put it that way. So, you know, I used to have a space report, we used to talk about it, you know, maybe 10 years ago, and then maybe a couple of weeks ago, you know, we'd go by, and then I'd come on again. But it became a regular thing 152 weeks ago, and I started keeping on, you know, a record on the computer. So if you ask me something like last week about the SMAP mission, I put in SMAP, and up comes, you know, SpaceNet Report 137, I think it was. You know, so I could review it and see what we talked about. The rest of the net I don't have. No, I just have the space portion. Back to you there.
Short announcement.
Fantastic. It turns out that 152 per year. That's roughly 3 years. So you've got 3 years worth of numbered space records, but you go back at least 10 years. Do you have a general announcement for ham radio that is brief west? M2XJN, K2LAW.
Is correct.
Can you tell me the subject matter?
It's motor turbo and digital radio. And it's helpful for everybody. Okay. There is a guy who is offering for 25 years, for $25, tune any kind of digital radio. What I understand, I sent you and also Rich and Lou and Bernie the information to retune the radio, and this is what I understand, trim it to the needs of ham radio operation. And the link for that you have basically what he's doing is he has the Aeroflex 3920 and he's tuning ATS 5000, APX 6000, APX 7000, APR 6550, XPR 7550 turbo, motor turbo radios, and from the description that he gives is it is for the service perform using an Aeroflex 3920 auto turbo test. The action will, he's available on eBay just to let people announce, know there are 65 guys that already signed within 2 days to this guy, and he already did perform some jobs. The auto-tune 2 feature will go through the all of the alignment procedures and automatically reset the unit to factory specifications. If you want to, values that are within the spec are shown as the path and whatever. So the cost is $25 per radio, plus $12 return shipping. There is a telephone number. The telephone number to the guy is 303-550-2277. His name is David. So it's 303-550-2277. He is doing also Astro 25 portable radios, the EXDS 3000, 1500, 2500, 5000 Astro Spectra, XTR 1500, XTR 2500, XTR 5000. Also, APX portable mobiles, there would be APX 6000, 7000, 6500, 7500, Motorola, Motor Turbo portable radios and mobiles. And within them, he reached XPR6300, XPR6550, XPR7550, XPR450 plus others. Motorola XPR repeaters. That could be many repeaters, but he reached XPR8300 and XPR8400. That's Aeroflex, which is former Marconi, offers FM, AM, AM, USB, AM, LSB, P25, conventional C4FM, / LSFM, CQPSK, phase 2. So, well, actually, everything possible on a smart zone, smart net.
I'm going to have to interrupt you, Wes. You fibbed to me. You promised it was going to be a brief announcement of some kind. You're now listing all the radios in the world that can be reset in a digital manner. You've already taken 5 minutes. I've got to stop you.
Sorry about that. Dick.
The first person who signed in was Steve, KC2MVP. Steve, go right on with your question. You got it, Steve. K2LIW.
They're up with us, and we know exactly where the guy is and who the guy is, and we can shut down the guy. I believe that the information that is important, and for that importance, even if I took 5 minutes of the time, I believe that I did the right job. At your GM.
You got it, Steve.
Thank you, Dick. No problem. I got a question on the new DMR radio. Like you said, I picked one up today at the local ham fest. It's a little portable job. And the nice thing is it's pretty much programmed. I just have a few questions, so I'll throw it out to the net out there and see if anyone can give me some help on this. Okay, question number one is, I applied for my DMR ID. I got that really quick. I entered that into the radio. My only question is I see it, it's almost like a D-Star where your call sign comes up. My question is, how do I program that? Is that through my ID, or do I physically have to program that call sign in there? And second question is the Limewalk DMR repeater. I've tried looking for information on it. I have no idea the location or the call sign. Someone told me they're not issued a call sign yet, which I find hard to believe. So any information on that would be greatly appreciated. Thank you, Dick.
Hey, John. There's a man who knows. You got the floor, Eric, and fill us in on this brand-new cutting-edge thing called DMR, which I'll bet you, if I know you, you've already installed some of the equipment. You got it, Eric.
You know, I
just
got to ask if Bernie's around, because Bernie's really the spokesperson for it. The DMR appears at 449-375. If you've got a code plug ready to go, that'll be pretty easy. As far as like making the call sign come up, that act occurs outside of your radio. Although you have to load, if you want to see other people's call signs, you have to load a database into your radio. Anyway, let's see if K2IO is here and slow down on the way the order of things. And by the way, Dick, AMB2 is a really awful codec. You know, they squeeze it down to 6.25 kilobits worth of audio, and it sounds terrible. But I'm fine. K2IO, come here, K2IO. See if K2IO is out there.
I think I've heard some Moto Turbo communication in the past on the two-way handy talkies that some of my radio people and friends are using, and sometimes it sounds kind of yucky, worse than some of the worst cell phones. Let's see if Bernie's available. K2 Yankee Oscar, you're needed. K2RIW, go ahead, Bernie. Hey. Eric, you were supposed to arrange to have Bernie here. You didn't follow through. One more call about Bernie, and if not, you pick up and tell us whatever you know about it, Eric, because you had your hands on the equipment. And although we're not going to guarantee that everything on this brand new technology is accurate in the beginning. Tell us what you can. So K2YO, and if not, K2EJ. K2I, if you're listening. Actually, I should have said K6YO. Eric, you got it.
What do you want to know? You want to know how it looks? You want to know the technical part of it? You want to know what the vocoder is and how much space it takes up? There's a commercial device that's not brand new. It's actually quite old at this point. That's why there's much better codecs that are out there today than what they use. They call it vocoder. Essentially, what they do is they remove from what you don't need. And it has actually a very narrow range of input levels in which in order to do the companding and the splicing and the frequency bunching properly. So when all things are given equal, it actually doesn't sound too bad, but as you listen to people on EMRs, you'll find that there's audio levels all over the place. You get varying different levels of clarity out of it. Let me let it drop. Okay. My hearing problem doesn't help with the EMRs, because a lot of the phonem sounds which are filtered, a lot of the harmonic resonance that I use in my range is missing. So, clarity and speech and the sibilance, which I don't hear, because I get it from the harmonics that are missing, and that's why I feel the way I do about it, but that doesn't necessarily mean you will. But, where do you want me to go? And I'll tell you.
I'm going to zoom back a little recognized. I'm going to zoom back pretty far and pass it back to you first, Eric. And that is, I am guessing that the DMR that Limark is installing right now is primarily UHF repeater equipment, most likely located at Glen Oaks, and maybe eventually in Selden, maybe eventually in Plainview. So I presume it's a UHF repeater that takes this digital information. I presume eventually it's going to have call letters. I'm hearing somebody saying it doesn't yet have call letters. It's not officially listed yet. And so a person with a DMR radio going through a DMR-equipped repeater, I presume, is taking voice that has been digitally encoded, which I guess could be used for security reasons if you want to. The person going through the repeater has to be recognized as someone that has been registered and approved, so to speak. And then he's able to talk to his friends and maybe even select which friends. And I think eventually it's going to have some cell phone-like properties where you can dial the right kind of a number into the thing, and it'll connect you between this DMR repeater and one that's in Chicago, so to speak. And now it's a little bit like Echolink, and you're talking out of Chicago, but by the DMR mode. Bunch of guesses on my part. Please correct me. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the deck net.
No, I'm pretty close, Jake. Not too far off. The DMR velocity is a little bit different. First of all, you've got to remember it's a device that was built for the commercial world, and especially for police and fire departments. So, you'll find radios actually having a panic button on it. In the Motorola series of radios, you could actually turn the mic on. So, hit the panic button, you're a policeman, you have something going on, dispatch can actually turn your mic on and hear what the heck is going on as they're sending help. There's a lot of things that are built into this. If you stay with the Moto Turbo, which has all the options, and the options that are in the radio is actually you have to buy, of course, the commercial endeavor. Within the Moto Turbo world, you can actually select which radios can talk to you, In the DMR amateur radio world, that doesn't exist. Essentially, the repeater is in a pipe. The receiver has got a data separator in the front. It comes out with IMQ. It streams, it goes through a little processing. The stream actually goes into the transmitter directly into the excited. It comes out. So whatever it receives, the way these repeaters are set up, it just passes everything through. It's also time to be multiplex, which means that the output is going on and off every 23 milliseconds. So that's the duration of a packet. And the circuitry is quite interesting, whereas you would see if you would think that you could use a normal brick or a small amplifier to take your HT and turn it into many watts, you're going to find out that that doesn't work. You need an amplifier that actually finds the training signal and turns it on and off along with the radio. So, that's an interesting...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Boy, that guy talks.
How much did you miss?
We only missed about 10 seconds. Not to worry, Eric.
God, he talks.
Okay. Well, the repeater is in plain view. And the way it's set up is we're connected to something called the receiver. So, they have these things called talkers. But there are a set of sort of predetermined channels. There's a channel called Tri-State, a channel called North America. There's a channel called Worldwide. There's a Spanish channel, or this channel, or that channel. It is less like IOLP and Echolink, where you can direct towards a specific computer in a specific location, where this is more a sort of like a telephone party line. Talk will be its own thing. And if you happen to be in France and you're interested in talking to someone worldwide, go to Worldwide and you'll find somebody here. A lot of these systems are what they call push-to-talk or PTT, which actually turns the circuit on. Because the transmitters are two-channel devices or two-time-slot devices, as they call them. You don't want to have to go in all the time, so wake up the channel and you can talk on it. If you were to have all of them going all at the same time, you would never be able to get in because of the way things are organized. I'd have to explain that a little bit more, but it takes up a lot of the time division, so your radio has to sync up to the repeater in order to make a transmission, and then has to have an empty slot in order to transmit into. So, that's why I got these cases done.
Christ!
I'm going to guess, Eric, that you possibly purchased the DMR hardware at Dayton this year. That implies that you've installed it within the last month. Therefore, it's been operational for a couple of weeks. Make a rough guess. How many of the local people and or Limon people have used it so far? And I presume the user list is probably going up pretty fast. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Now, if my boy Fanny was around, he could give you the exact tally. It's my understanding that we have 85 members with radios and IDs. So, actually... you can monitor the traffic that's happening on our cross loop. And you can see, the usual crowd that you found on other DMR repeaters like the MQPN and a few other folks. And then, you know, we've got our folks that now all active in it, and just, a lot of people use it. Actually, when we brought it home from Dayton, I put it on the air that same. I got home. So we actually had changed the frequency system so we could do our own experimenting. We decided to decide which antenna I want to use and stuff like that. So, but now it's just open for better use.
Whiskey Q, Bravo Mike Papa with a comment.
Sure, real quick question on that.
And I'm still on deck, MY2H.
Yeah, I know. We've got Lou waiting. One more question for you, Eric, and that is, there's a question that had to be answered. I'm going to turn it over to Lou first. NY2H, K2RIW, go ahead, Lou.
Go ahead, Harry.
All right, three quick comments. Bernie is on Echo Link. I don't know if he's listening or not. And the Sedlin machine went down. We're on the ROP link now, so I had to quickly switch antennas and switch back to this frequency. In BMP, he had said we have no call. Now, obviously, we have a call. The situation is that we wanted to use memorial call because a lot of the funds were taken out of a memorial fund, and there was a call that was preferred to be used, but the FCC limited the number of vanity calls a club could have. So for now, I would say the call would be the W2KPU call. And Eric, I guess you should make sure that that machine is going to ID one of these calls at least every 10 minutes. NY2H back to net.
And Lou, I'm guessing that you reconfigured the Eastern repeater by way of an internet connection because I'm hearing it with delay. It is up and it's working, but it's doing so with a delay. Eric and Lou, in that order, I'm going to ask you the question of lots of people have lots of questions on this brand new technology. If I go to the LimeLock website, LimeLock.org, although is it LimeLock.com? I'm going to guess it's LimeLock.org, which is a massive website which got zillions of pieces of information. It's got so darn many pieces of information. To find what you want is a little bit difficult. Is any of the DMR information there yet, or will it be in the near future? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
On completion, pick up K2 UPS when you get a chance.
Sure will. I called him earlier. Oh, he's got a question on this one, too. We got a long list of people here with questions. Eric, first, go ahead.
You know what? The phone is on Echo Link. Let's just wait and let him get into it. And I'm sure he's got all the intimate details that you're listening to. By the way, the call time, not to worry, Lou, it is W2KPU. It actually identifies it every 10 minutes. So it's perfectly legal. It's also registered as such, so I get it myself. Let's leave a very long pause. Go ahead, Barry.
It goes to Barry. Go ahead, Barry. We're waiting, Barry.
Hang on a second while I reiterate.
Ahead, Barry. Where'd you go, Barry?
Right now we've got W2BM.
Go ahead, Bernie. All right, I guess he's not listening. Let me throw it back at you, Dick.
Sorry.
Okay. I see if W2BMP and N2MP in that order right now is coming up. W2BMP, go right ahead with your question or comment.
Thanks, Dick. I have an unofficial count of 63 people using DMR. And my wife and I are using DMR. We got our DMR radio yesterday, and it's fantastic. I just got off of a QSO with a guy in the UK from my living room on my HT, which is the HT antenna. So my question is, how soon before you make the DMR plug there, Dick? Back to you.
Dick, Bernie is communicating. He cannot transmit. That seems to be a problem there. So we'll carry on and pick him up as soon as he's able.
Very fine, John. The person you just heard, W2BMP, is Joe. He's the president of our club. And he's basically asking me how long is it going to be before I get on the bandwagon. And it's a good question. Let's see. Barry is the next person with what he said was a quick question. N2, moonbound, K2RIW. Go ahead, Barry.
Okay, thanks, Dick. Yeah, I'll make it real quick. In the beginning, Moto Turbo was, in my opinion, not that clear. Eric touched on that a second ago. Did they make any changes at ZOO or DMR? Is it real clear? Have they changed anything that would make that clear? And 2MB, over.
Does anyone want to answer that one?
I couldn't hear the question.
I guess Barry is basically asking, has anybody changed the audio so that it becomes a little bit more clear? I think Barry is complaining that he doesn't like distorted sounding audio. And I guess he's basically asking, will the audio always be distorted, or is there an improvement coming all, down the pipe? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah,
K2RIW,
K2EJ. There we go. The codec that they use is actually in DSP in some of the radios, but it's a form of codec that the bandwidth that it takes up. And as far as it improving, it's about 8 to 10 years old at this point now, and there's been other codecs that do a better job in less space, but this was selected when it was selected. It's pretty much going to stay that way, otherwise you start creating an incompatible codec that won't work.
I understood that.
Very good. Okay, Rich, I know you wanted to make a comment, and later on I'd like to...
I think that was my error. I was confused with Bernie's call sign.
Okay, but later on we are going to be asking for Rich KTUPS to describe his portable operation, which is a real fun operation that I think some of us are going to be interested in. So, Steve, you've asked a pretty deep question. I know you've only gotten a partial answer, but more will follow, is my impression. KT2MDV, and you can tell us if you want a clarification on anything so far. KT2MDV, K2RIW, go ahead, Steve.
Thank you, Dick. Very good. It's pretty interesting. I'm getting into it. I don't want to transmit, you know, without that ID, which I just got. And just one quick question. They have a thing that's basically called parry, which basically transmits your audio back to you. I guess it's like an echo test, basically. And I get an ID on that. It's like 9998. Is that normal? I'll throw it out to Eric. He might know.
You got it, Eric.
Yeah, that's perfectly normal. That's the talk loop. Talk loop is actually 9998. And basically it's a piece of software that takes the stream and sends it back out.
So, by way of that 9998 talk group thing, I guess a person could be adjusting his equalizer, his volume, change microphones or whatever. And in theory, what he hears back from that parrot operation lets him know what he's going to sound like on other radios that of people that he's talking to. Is that roughly it, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
That's exactly it. Actually, there's another one which we don't have. I don't think we have it set up. Which actually has a meter, so the correct level. I'm going to play the back for you. And I just wanted to say that Mr. DMP, that, you know, you could sit back and talk to France and England on our UHF machine, sitting in his chair using ILLP, but he never seems to have done that, so I guess he doesn't know. But yeah, actually you'll find that the difference between the two is that you can direct yourself to a particular zone. I have a friend in Japan, and I always call up Tokyo, you know, so we have conversations, you know, as opposed to worldwide. You know, you can make arrangements with someone. Whatever. K2RIW, K2J.
Okay. Well, if like a brand new developing technology, and we're going to be hearing more about it, I can tell. I think even people have been suggesting that there should be an hour before the tech at 7:30 to 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock in which this technology is being discussed. So maybe people will do that. We'll soon see. Next person on our list was Rich, N2EO. Go right ahead, Rich, N2EO, K2LAW, and the tech man.
Okay, thank you, Dick, N2EO. I was going to ask a question for Pat on behalf of Barry. You know, I know him over 40 years. We've been friends. He has an RIW 19. You know what I'm talking about. He was up on the tower today, found that, I think they call it a hairpin match. It's a U-shaped piece of 8-inch copper hard line. One end broke because of the salt there in Rockaway. He wants to know if you have a piece of that, that either you can nail him or he can come out. And what we're both curious is on the GeoStefan amplifier, what tones does he use? Are they 8874s? Are they 4CX250s? Or and is it fashioned after the RIW kilowatt? Over to you, Dick, and to you.
Okay, the so-called RIW 19 Yagis, which were invented way back in the dark ages of 1977, 1978, on a backyard ratiometry outdoor antenna testing range. And you can read about that in the 1976, I think it is, issue of QST Magazine. I think it's the February or March issue, the UHF ratiometry by K2RIW. And so with that technique, by which you can see a 20th of a dB of increase or decrease in the gain of a antenna while you're tuning it, that 19-element Yagi came out of that. And the driven element is fed with a half-wave coax balance. That U-shaped piece of 8-inch diameter thing that you see is really, it's called UT-141. Let me drop it. Arguably the most famous company is the Uniform Tubes Company. They changed names. The Uniform Tubes Company in New Jersey makes a very famous kind of coaxial cable, semi-rigid coaxial cable called UT-141. It is exactly 0.141 diameter, outside diameter. It is 50 ohm, semi-hard line, Teflon insulated coaxial cable. There's nothing magic about that. Any piece of coaxial cable, and by the way, because it's exactly a half wavelength long, the impedance doesn't matter. Ain't that crazy? You can use 75 ohm, 50 ohm, 30 ohm, whatever coax cable for that half wave balance. So a half wave U-shaped thing where the center conductor on each end goes to the left-hand side and the right-hand side of the folded dipole that's the driven element on that antenna. One end gets fed by your input transmission line. Nothing very magic about that. So replacing it is pretty easy. Even if you if the piece broke off and you cut back some of the outer shield, the outer conductor of that semi-rigid cable, you cut it back another eighth of an inch or a quarter of an inch, and therefore you're going to have a quarter of an inch or a half inch of error in the length. That length is extremely forgiving. In other words, you can take that U-tube thing, that U-shaped thing, and make it an inch too long, an inch too short, and you would have great difficulty measuring the difference in performance or a difference in standing wave ratio. Let me drop it. Barry, being a microwave guy from way back, guarantee he's got somewhere in his junk box, he's got pieces of semi-rigid 8-inch diameter coaxial cable. Lots and lots of people use it. And if you substitute anything else that's weatherproof, it'll work like a charm. So, do I have some pieces of that? Yes, I do. But there's lots of ways that Barry can get a hold of that. Barry and I are going to be coming together face-to-face sometime in the next week and a half, because he's about to pick up a nice high-power amplifier. The so-called parallel kilowatt amplifiers that I wrote the article on in April and May, QST 1972, did use 4CX250B as a tube. commercial products when Steve Polishing, K1FFO, when he made a commercial product out of it, he decided to use a higher power tube. So all of his parallel silhouette amplifiers use a 3CX800A7, a pair of them. Brand new, those tubes list for $800. And on the surplus market, you can typically buy them for $400. The nice thing about them, those tubes on that amplifier, and the reason why Steve chose those tubes, is they're known to be extremely high in linearity. The modulation, distortion, and harmonics out of that are very low. On top of that, since each one of those tubes can dissipate 800 watts, and there's a pair of them in there, that amplifier is capable of running an extremely cool 1500 watts of power output, and people have pushed it considerably beyond that. So that amplifier, which is about a 4-pound amplifier, not counting the power supply, put out 1500 watts keyed down forever, because you're using a cathode-driven service with a triode tube, the 3CX800A7. It does take either 50 or 100 watts of drive, but the moonbound guys just fell in love with that one. Let's see if Barry's got any further questions on this. This is what Barry is about to acquire, and when it appears in his shack, I think it's going to glow in the dark. You wait and see. And two moonbounds, K2LIW. Go ahead, Barry.
Yeah, I'll do my best to try to overload those tubes. You answered the other question I had right away, how much drive. It turns out I have just the right amount of drive. That's marvelous. And you answered my other question. I can drive it beyond 1,500 watts. I probably will. Oh, you did. K2MV, that's great.
By way of your special temporary authority from the FCC, while you're doing moonbound operation and the antenna's aimed up in the air, yes, without a doubt, perfectly legal for you to go beyond the 1500 watts. The nice thing about that amplifier, from what I hear, is it puts out an extremely clean 1500 watts peak envelope power with single sideband with no flat topping. So you're going to be putting out hi-fi audio in sideband as long as your driver has that capability. Okay, good luck with that project, Barry, and
one question, Dick.
I'll try to find a piece of that semi-rigid just to keep you happy when you and I meet face-to-face in the next week and a half. Go ahead with your question, Barry.
You answered my second question. I'll be expecting to pick up that little piece of coax when I see you. Thank you very much.
Dick, there's even a slim chance that I have one made by the master W2KRM. He's the guy who is manufacturing those amplifiers, George Flanagan. I may even have one that was tailor-made by him. Go ahead, Rich. 2EO, K2LIW.
Dick. Bring the one there. Barry uses plate voltage. Does that unit have a flip circuit on the screen? I have my AL1500. You remember I had the second tube? And I had to rework the flip circuit. It worked great when I lost, did lose a couple of times, plate voltage. Does it have a flip circuit? I hope so.
Yeah, what you guys are hearing are pieces of a conversation, so to speak. And I'll give you a little bit of clarity what's going on here. In the case of a tetro tube, the 4CX250B tubes, a pair of them were the original amplifier, the so-called RIW parallel kilowatt amplifier. That tetro tube gives you beautiful gain if you put 350 volts on the screen grid, 2,000 volts on the plate, and drive those tubes, a pair of them with 10 watts, and out comes 700 watts with close to 20 dBs of gain. So it's a very happy, cool amplifier. However, if you're driving the amplifier and the control grid and cathode is yanking all kinds of zillions of electrons off that cathode and shipping them toward the plate, and if for some reason the plate voltage should fail, and now all of those electrons, a half ampere of them that would have gone to the plate, are now going to go to the screen grid, and the screen grid can't take more than 30 milliamps, and you put half an ampere into those screen grids, you'll burn them up in 3 seconds, so to speak. So there's a protection circuit on tetro tubes that turns off the screen voltage if the plate voltage isn't there. In the case of this amplifier, it's a 3CX100 36887. Because it is a Tri-Young 2, there is no screen grid, therefore no screen grid protection circuit is required. But, let me drop. Now you've got the equivalent problem. When you're cranking 100 watts into that cathode, of this cathode-driven, grounded grid, triode tube, 1500 watts amplifier, if you lose the plate voltage, so you're still making that control grid and cathode yank zillions of electrons off that cathode, more than half an ampere of them, and they normally would be going to that plate of this triode tube, and if that plate voltage is not there, you're now expecting the control grid to absorb half an ampere of current, and you'll burn up that control grid real fast. So there still has to be a protection circuit. If the plate voltage is not there, in the case of a triode, you're protecting the control grid. In the case of a tetrode, you're protecting the screen grid. So in either case, is there a protection circuit there? Because Bruce and 2LIV had this commercial amplifier in service for a number of years, I'm almost positive somewhere along the line there is a protection circuit. We'll have to look into that. So I wonder if you've got any further questions on this, Barry, because on these $800 tubes, I can see why you'd want to go a little bit easy with them, and you'd cry a little bit if you burned one of them up in 5 seconds by doing one of these errors. And two moon bounce. The guy who really does do moon bounce, K2RIW in the TechNet, you got it, Barry.
I'm not going to occupy the frequency anymore, so I should check that thing out very carefully for both of us to make sure it does have some kind of protection. That's about it. N2MB, Rockaway Beach. Carry on, folks. Every question answered. Amazing.
We anticipated some of your questions. And Eric, KE2EJ, in the case of some of your super high power tubes that you used to use in your broadcast service, I bet there are all kinds of protection in there to make sure you didn't burn up the control grids if the high voltage is lost. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Hello, 60 kilowatt transmitter. Remember, I had a deuterium dose and a charge in the crowbar. And the thing worked within, what, 300 microseconds, I think? Damn bad. Made a very big black flash of light in the ceramic. Made a very loud noise at the same time. Now, what I was going to say is that one of the things that we tend to expect is the screen grid capacity has a tendency to break down. You've got to watch for that. That will make you most of that is fine. But most Chris broadcast transmitters, at least FM transmitters, not only do they kill the screen voltage, but they kill the drive voltage. You can probably not change your deck.
Now, the safest protection circuit in the world, in my opinion, is the one that appeared in my article in the May issue 1972 on that amplifier, and that is the screen grid supply voltage had something like a 2,000 ohm resistor in series with that screen grid. Therefore, if the plate voltage is lost and the screen grid starts drawing high current, the voltage drop across the 2,000 ohm resistor brings the screen grid voltage down to a safe number, and no matter what you do, you can't exceed 30 milliamperes of current into that screen grid when that resistor is there. And the resistor, of course, was also backed up with a bypass, a couple of microfarads, as I remember, to make sure the screen voltage is held there during the peak of single sideband. But what I used to do is to literally intentionally turn off the high voltage, the 2,000 volts, on the plate. Now the screen grid would take over, the protection circuit on the screen grid did take over, and the amplifier would put out 1 watt. Instead of putting out 700 watts. So when I wanted to go to low power output, I didn't have to do a whole lot of changes of drive circuits and putting in attenuators and doing whatever. I just turned off the switch on the 2,000 volts on the amplifier. You can do that with a tetrode. I don't think you can do that with a triode. And I was only using a grid drive of 10 watts, total to two tubes, 5 watts per tube. So everything was fairly safe. And that was a very convenient way of going to low power. And I wasn't smart enough to put that in the article. At the time I wrote the article, I hadn't discovered this implementation yet. High-power amplifiers with tubes. Let me drop.
Hey, Dick, you know, all broadcast tetrodes
bulb is on the screen, grid is the amount of power up, but that's the power control for the transmitter.
The case of the tetro tubes that we use, 4CX250B and that series, oh boy, is that true. When you go from 250 volts on the screen grid to 350 volts on the screen grid, you go from something like 400 watts of output to something like 800 watts of output. The magic of a tetrode high-power beam grid tube used for transmitting service is that the current, that peak current that can be drawn by the plate, is a function of the voltage you put on the screen grid raised to the 3/2 power. So the peak current capability of the tube goes up real fast. You put 400 or 450 volts on that screen grid, and my goodness, does that amplifier come alive. Wow. It can't put out enough power. It'll burn up, that amplifier will burn up a piece of RG8U coax cable. The 700 watts or 800 watts of continuous key down output will melt almost melt the polyethylene dielectric on a piece of RG8 or RG214 cable. And so, you'd be amazed how limp that piece of cable would become when you're using that kind of power. And using tubes for a final stage when you're running that kind of power is a very convenient way to go. Those tubes are very forgiving. Power supplies are very easy to build. You try to build the solid state equivalent if you want a home brew.
Oh, I'm
going to
disagree with you there.
Because in your business, Eric, you've got this great big pile of money. You go to a very good broadcast transmitter designer, a supplier. You give him a great big check, and he makes you a beautiful solid-state power amplifier that's got a zillion watts of output. And if you and I try to homebrew that, you're going to spend an awful lot of man hours and an awful lot of dollars getting the hardware to do that, just the power supply, because solid-state equipment, quite typically of these UHF frequencies, runs at 10 or 15 volts maximum. So now you need a 500 ampere well-regulated power supply. Those words roll off the tongue very slowly. You better not do that.
Stone Age.
Yeah, I'm in the Stone Age. But to build a conventional amplifier with 2,000 volts with 10 microfarads of filter oil-filled capacitors, that's a very convenient power supply that doesn't require all kinds of electronic protection. So to you in your business, we can just write a check and the problem goes away. It seems simple. For us poor people out here that have to homebrew things like that or try to buy it, if I wanted 2,000 watts or 1,500 watts peak envelope power capability sideband today, I think I got to write a pretty big check or I've got to do a lot of man hours of work in my guess. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
All right, Mr. RF. K2RIW, I feel you, Mr. Microwave. K2RIW, K2JS, I go to the Freescale website, okay? I can't remember the number of the transistors. This will produce 1.5 kilowatts average power, fully protected. You can put a short arm in front of it, and it doesn't care. It actually makes a nice draw. If you go to the Freescale website, you can see a little demo that they have. They're actually doing it for me. Thing goes all the way up to you again. It's actually one chip, you know, you can figure it's a slab with like a zillion transistors built onto it. Using a 50 volt power supply, unregulated, it has to be reasonably clean as well. It's great, you know, for the FM pulse if you're doing class C. But if you want to buy it just for class A, B, more power to you, just need a really clean power supply. You can get the board without the filters from Far Circuits for a reasonable cost. The chip is about $160. Can you throw it up to KQ?
So a used one, $160, gets me 1.5 kilowatts of key down power output up to 2 meters and maybe even 450. Impressive. That particular chip with that performance, I'm guessing that's relatively new, the last 5 years or so. How long has that been around, Eric? Go ahead.
The non-protected version was released, I think, 2.5 years ago. And the protected version was, like, about 2 years ago now. But, you know, it's Freescale. They're the same people that used to have them in Motorola. You know, They're the ones that made all the MRF transistors. Well, anyway, this thing's a real cool device. I've seen a few of them that people have built. You don't need a humongous heat sink, but really you just need a slab of heat sink. The boss I can afford is slab.